Please take your Bibles and turn with me this morning to Romans, the 13th chapter. And I'd ask you to follow along as I read the first paragraph, verses 1 through 7. Romans 13, 1 through 7. Every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For it is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword for nothing. For it is a minister of God, an avenger, who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. Therefore, it is necessary to be in subjection, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience's sake. For because of this you also pay taxes. For rulers are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing. Render to all what is due them. Tax to whom tax is due. Custom to whom custom. Fear to whom fear. Honor to whom honor. After four introductory studies, we began last Lord's Day our actual exposition of this great paragraph, dealing as it does with the whole issue of church and state. Our focus last Lord's Day was on verses 1 through 3, and therein Paul deals with the imperative of Christian submission to authority, the basis of Christian submission to authority, the warning against unrighteous rebellion, and the evaluation of the basically good job that the civil authorities were doing in Paul's day when he wrote this letter. But our text for this morning is only on verse 4. Verse 4 says the following. Speaking of the civil magistrate, Paul says the following. For it is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword for nothing. For it is a minister of God, an avenger, who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. Please follow along then as I make several observations as to the meaning and also as to the application of this text to our lives. I'd like you to consider in the first place this morning the titles given to the civil authority. And the titles given to the civil authority in these verses were to pay very close attention to. They are called ministers of God. They are called servants of God. Two times in verse 4, the civil authorities are referred to as ministers of God. One time in verse 6, the civil authorities, the Gentile authorities in Paul's day, are referred to as servants of God. And most men, when they think of a minister of God, if you were to poll most people today and say, now, what is a minister of God? What does a minister of God look like? The majority of Americans would answer as follows. They would say that a minister of God is a man whose vocation it is to study, to pray, to counsel, to preach, to help people. And that is what comes to mind when most people think of a minister of God. They think of a man like myself whose vocational calling in life is to be a man who spends time in the study of the Scriptures, the proclamation of the Scriptures, prayer, counseling, coming to the assistance of people, visiting people. This is the function of the minister of God. And that is what most people would think of when we use this phrase, the minister of God. But here, in Romans 13 and verse 4, and also in verse 6, we are taught that our concept of ministers of God needs to be much wider in scope. We are taught that those who serve the state as legislators, that those who serve the state as judges, that those who serve the state as policemen and women, that those who serve the state as soldiers and sailors and marines and airmen, that they too are referred to in this passage of the Scriptures as ministers of God, as servants of God, who perform duties that are absolutely essential to God-ordained government. And so you and I are to have a very wide concept as to who is a minister of God. And so as we examine the titles that Paul gives, we find that he speaks of the civil authorities as being ministers of God, servants of God. But now we note in the second place that another title that Paul gives to the civil authority is that of avenger. The civil government is given the duty of being, quote, an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. We have already learned in our exposition of Romans 12 and verse 19 that while private vengeance is condemned by God's word, official governmental vengeance is required to punish evildoers and safeguard the peace. There is no good civil government if civil government does not fulfill its role as a minister of God to also be an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. And so in the first place, we see the titles that the apostle gives to the civil authorities: ministers of God, servants of God, and avenger. Very, very significant titles that we all need to pay attention to in this dangerous time in which we live in the world. Consider in the second place the ministry entrusted to these ministers of God. If there are ministers, they have a ministry. Paul has described the ministers, and now he tells us what their ministry is in the world, what their calling is in the world. So consider in the second place the ministry entrusted to these ministers of God. And their ministry is described both positively and negatively. A positive ministry that they are to have to encourage the good, and a negative ministry that they are to have to punish the evil. And so let's examine both ministries of these servants of God. And we ought to think in the first place about the positive ministry that the civil government ought to have in the world. Verse 4 actually begins in the middle of a sentence. And when Paul says that the state is a minister of God to you for good, he has already said that when the state is functioning in its God-appointed role, it will provide praise for the citizen who does good. And that is a function of the civil magistrate that far too often is overlooked. I was speaking to one of our policemen and asking him, you know, when you get pulled over on the side of the road, do they ever look at your record? And if you're a driver like me with absolutely no points on my record, you know, with just a sterling long record of obedient driving, do they ever look at that and just say, you go on your way, you deserve nothing but praise from us? And I was informed, no, that's not what the police do. That's not what they do at all. But you say that is something that the government, in some capacity, ought to be doing. There is to be a positive recognition, as it were, in society of those who live orderly, decent lives, and there ought to be recognition and some form of award, in some sense, for those who do the good. And that is far too often overlooked by the civil authorities. I've often thought that if I was, say, a small town mayor, I would like to have, as part of my job, looking in the community, looking at the people who deserve praise and somehow praise them and give them recognition. I've often thought that this is something that would not only do a good job at the time, but would encourage more people to live exemplary lives. I've often thought that the job of the civil magistrate ought to be to absolutely, in a ruthless manner, to sit down and absolutely honestly ask these questions: what is the behavior that benefits society the most, and what is the behavior that hurts society the most, and what is our function as legislators to encourage the behavior that benefits society the most and to discourage the behavior that hurts society the most? And if I were a legislator, I would want to ask those questions. And I would want to do something like this: identify the behavior that costs America the most, and then begin to tax it into oblivion. And identify the behavior that helps America the most, and lighten the taxes on those people to encourage even more. Wouldn't that be a good thing to do? Wouldn't that be wonderful? I'm not making a stump speech here at all this morning, but I would say that that's what I would want to do. I would want to identify the behavior that costs you and I the most. I mean, what behavior costs America the most? Billions of dollars in tax dollars, and we could all write a list of the kind of behavior that costs the most. And so who would we want to have as the highest taxed people in America? We'd want to have as the people who are taxed the most in America the people that cost us the most to support them. And we would want to discourage their lifestyle because they cost us too much. And the people that benefit society the most, we would want to encourage them. This is why the president, for instance, is absolutely adamant that the marriage penalty tax has to be scrapped. What he's doing is following Romans 13 and verse 4. The reality is that since about 1956, those of us who are married with children have had our taxes go up from 100% to 400%. And it's advantageous for people just to shack up together and to live together in America. And the president says, I want to stop all that. And we ought to encourage that. And say what we want to encourage in America is proper behavior that doesn't cost our country a lot. What we want to do is to discourage the kind of behavior that ends up costing us billions. And if some legislators got that idea from Romans 13 and ruthlessly followed it, it would be wonderful for our land. So there's a positive role that the civil government is to have. It is to encourage good behavior. But you notice, consider the negative but necessary ministry of the civil authorities. And the civil authorities are called to, from this passage, to instill fear in the one who would contemplate evil. Our text says, but if you do what is evil, be afraid. And the only way to instill fear is by the real threat of using force, so that anyone who would contemplate evil has to reckon with the reality that overwhelming force may descend upon him if he carries out his plans. And that is a function, an absolutely vital function of the civil magistrate, when he is carrying on his duties in a God-honoring way. The civil authorities are called to be an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. For this role, God has granted the state the right and the responsibility to use the sword. And that is an absolute necessary right and responsibility. The civil authorities are called to be an avenger and to use the sword in executions without it being considered a violation of the sixth commandment. And when God established civil government, way back in Genesis chapter 9, what did he say? Whoever sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God he created man. And when civil government was established by God, he put into the hands of the civil government the sword to be used to instill fear in the one who would practice evil. The judge who sentenced Timothy McVeigh to death and the executioner who carried out his execution were no more guilty of murder themselves than the judge who sentences someone to pay a fine is guilty of theft. The civil government is called upon by God to cause anybody who would contemplate evil to be afraid. And if they carry out their evil, the government is called upon to be an avenger who brings down wrath on the one who practices evil. Winston Churchill said the following in the first volume of his multi-volume series on the Civil War, or on World War II, rather. Winston Churchill wrote some eloquent words with regard to the basic function of civil government. And here's what Churchill wrote. Their duty is first so to deal with other nations as to avoid strife and war and to eschew aggression in all its forms, whether for nationalistic or ideological objects. But the safety of the state, the lives and freedom of their fellow countrymen to whom they owe their position, make it right and imperative in the last resort, or when a final and definite conviction has been reached, that the use of force should not be excluded. If the circumstances are such as to warrant it, force may be used. Now listen to these words. And if this be so, it should be used under the conditions that are most favorable. There is no merit in putting off a war for a year if when it comes it is far worse war or one much harder to win. It almost sounds as if it was written this week, rather than at the end of World War II. And so we consider, in the second place, then, the function, as it were, that God has granted to the state, the ministry entrusted to these ministers of God. This is indeed what God's word calls the civil magistrate to be, and what God calls the civil magistrate to do. The great Southern Presbyterian, Robert Louis Dabney, said this with regard to the function of the civil magistrate to be an avenger who brings God's wrath on the one who practices evil. Listen to this. It would be strange indeed if the ruler who is armed by God with the power of capital punishment against the domestic murderer could not justly inflict the same doom on the foreign criminal who invades our soil unprovoked for the purpose of shedding blood. The security of life and property which the magistrate is intended to provide by his power of punishing would be illusory indeed if it could only be used against individual criminals, while the more mischievous and widespread crimes of organized multitudes must go unpunished. And what Dabney was saying is that the magistrate has the power to protect his people not only from the domestic criminal, but from the foreign criminal that would invade our soil and would attack and jeopardize our people. Well, we've looked at the titles of these ministers of God, and we've looked at the ministry of these ministers of God, but consider in the third place this morning the lessons of this passage. There is, in the first place, a lesson as to how to discern between good and poor government. If we take Romans chapter 13 and verse 4 seriously, we can have a means by which we can discern between good and poor government. The ability of citizens to live in peace, not strife, safety, not jeopardy, is an indication of the quality of its government. If a city or a country or a county is not safe to live in, it is a testimony to the failure of its leaders to fulfill their God-ordained role. That's what this passage teaches us. That's a lesson that is derived from this passage. Here is a lesson by which we can evaluate the government that is over us, or any government wherever you would go in the world. If you can live and work and travel in safety, it is likely good government. If you cannot live and work and travel in safety, it is not good government. The government is not fulfilling its role. A week ago yesterday, I attended a retirement banquet for a New Jersey state trooper. And at the banquet were a number of dignitaries, among which was the prosecutor for Essex County and many, many from his staff. They took up a whole table. And in their remarks there at the microphone, in speaking of the man that we were there to honor, they made some revelations about just how dangerous it is in Essex County, New Jersey these days, and how dangerous in particular it is in Newark, New Jersey these days. They made it clear that Essex County, New Jersey in general, and the city of Newark in particular, is one of the most dangerous areas in all of the United States of America. And when one compares, for instance, the tremendous decline in serious crime just across the river in New York City, and the tremendous increase of crime in Newark, New Jersey, from Romans chapter 13 and verse 4, you can come to conclusions about which city had the best leaders, which city had the leaders that were fulfilling their God-ordained role, and which city had the leader that is not fulfilling his God-ordained role. You see the point? We understand that from the election of Rudy Giuliani to the present, that New York City is a very, very safe city to go to and to walk around in today. Far better than it was years ago. Do you remember the time, not too many years ago, when you couldn't go into New York City without being in jeopardy? But today it's a totally different city. It's a totally, totally different city because a mayor came in who said, my first responsibility is to protect the people. And I'm going to go after little crime in the eyes of the people because I know where if I go after the little crimes, I'm going to deal with the big criminals too. So he got the squeegee guys off the street. He started prosecuting the people who would be guilty of graffiti, and prosecute them for defacing public property. He went after jaywalkers. He went after all the little crimes because he understood that the people who will break even the little laws will be the same people who will break the big laws. And he cleaned it up from the bottom up. You contrast that with the leadership of Sharp James in Newark. And you ask yourself the question, who is the better leader? And the better leader was the mayor of New York City, and a terrible mayor at this time is the Maronurek. This passage tells us that every leader in civil government ought to be a person who holds as his primary responsibility guaranteeing the safety and peace of its citizenry. And when those in civil authority understand that that is their primary role, then that is good government. But wherever you live, where you cannot work and travel in safety and peace, you know that the government that is over you is not fulfilling its God-ordained role. There is, in the second place in this passage, a lesson as to the leaders that are a danger to any country. We are living in absolutely interesting times. And what we're witnessing in our day is almost an identical repeat of what occurred just prior to World War II. It is amazing the parallels between 2003 with 1935. It is absolutely amazing whenever I turn on the news to see these parallels. And the reason we are following the mistakes of 1935 is people haven't learned the lessons of history. And it is absolutely essential that we learn from this passage a lesson as to leaders that are a danger to any country. Neville Chamberlain was the Prime Minister of Great Britain just prior to the outbreak of World War II. And what we're witnessing now, whenever we turn on the news, is what I call the Chamberlain Syndrome. We're seeing the Chamberlainization of France. We're seeing the Chamberlainization of Germany. We're seeing the Chamberlainization of Belgium. We're seeing the Chamberlainization of millions of people in Europe and millions of people in America. And you might say, well, Pastor Dykstra, what do you mean by the Chamberlainization of people? Well, I mean this. And here's a history lesson for you. Neville Chamberlain was the Prime Minister of Great Britain just prior to World War II, and he was an absolute disaster as a leader. And the reason that he was such a disaster was his inability to realize how evil a man was Adolf Hitler. And here, after a long record of how evil a man Adolf Hitler was, here are the words of Neville Chamberlain after he had a meeting with Adolf Hitler. Listen to the words of this man. Ponder his inability to size up the character of that evil man. Chamberlain said as follows, "In spite of the hardness and ruthlessness I thought I saw in his face, I got the impression that here was a man who could be relied upon when he had given his word." Well, I'm here to tell you, that's exactly the kind of prime minister a country does not want to have. Because here was a man who was absolutely, totally unable to size up the evil character of the man who sat across the table from him. And that is the kind of leader that no country should have. What an amazing statement. How in the world can we explain how an educated man could be so wrong in the assessment of danger to his country in particular and to civilization in general? Well, Charles Colson supplies the answer in chapter 11 of his excellent book entitled Kingdoms in Conflict. And here's the rest of the story as to how Neville Chamberlain developed into such a fool and why he was such a terrible leader for England at that particular time. Listen to this from Chuck Cole Colson. He had grown up in a tight-knit Unitarian family. They rejected the Christian belief in man's innate sinfulness, preferring to place faith in the innate goodness and reasonableness of man. Influential Britons of all backgrounds were infected by such thinking. Faith in the social sciences, in intellectual solutions to moral problems, had never been higher than in the 30s. The flourishing of Christian Science within Nancy Astor's influential circle at Cliveden was symptomatic. Christian scientists believe that all evil is an illusion that can be eliminated by the exercise of the mind. Chamberlain, who was close to many of the Cliveden group, lived among people to whom the harshness of human evil had ceased to be real. Hitler gave Chamberlain more than adequate evidence that he was evil, unreasonable, and bent on war, yet the Prime Minister could not, would not see it. You see Colson's point. His point is that Chamberlain was a Unitarian who did not believe the Bible doctrine about human sinfulness. He's saying that Neville Chamberlain was influenced by Lord and Lady Astor, who were Christian scientists, who alike did not believe in the depravity of man, didn't even believe in the reality of evil. And this is what explains why he could sit across at the table from an Adolf Hitler and not understand what an evil man he was. Here was a man who questioned the reality of evil. Colson goes on to say this. Nancy Astor was a devout Christian scientist who always had Christian science lecturers at her weekend gatherings. Lord Astor and Lord Lothian were Christian scientists too. Their sympathetic view of Germany was strengthened by the Christian science doctrine that man is good, that there is no evil that the mind cannot overcome. This Chamberlain was inclined to agree with, though he was quite irreligious himself. That's the worst kind of leader you could ever have. And that explains the background to the man. That is the worst kind of leader you could ever have. And it was that philosophy that led to him saying, in spite of the harshness and ruthlessness I thought I saw in his face, I got the impression that here was a man who could be relied upon when he had given his word. And we just want to throw up our hands in the air and come to the conclusion that's the worst kind of leader a country can have. Far better to have a Christian who understands the Bible doctrine of the total depravity of man. Far better to have a Christian who could see right through a guy like Adolf Hitler and deal with him when he was weak, rather than put off dealing with him until he got too strong. There is what we're finding now, what we're witnessing on every news program today, is the Chamberlainization of France, Germany, Belgium, the optimistic, liberal, give peace a chance, nonsensical way to deal with evil. That is what we're witnessing whenever we turn on the news today. Let me repeat that. We are witnessing the optimistic, liberal, give peace, nonsensical way to deal with evil. Winston Churchill got it right when he said this: tyrants respond only to the mailed fist. That doesn't mean a fist sent in the mail to you. That means a fist, kids, covered by a steel glove. And tyrants know only one language. They respond only to the mailed fist. And so here is a lesson about the kind of leaders that are a disaster and a danger to any country. Leaders like Neville Chamberlain, leaders like Jacques Chirac, leaders like the leader in Germany today, his name escapes me right now, Schroeder, leaders like that. They are a danger to their countries. There is, in the third place this morning, a lesson as to the methods that are doomed to fail in dealing with the ruthless. Winston Churchill said this in The Gathering Storm, and again, this could be written today, because he chronicles what happened in 1935, April 15 through 17, 1935, with the League of Nations. And a problem country in the League of Nations. All you need to do is change the dates. Listen to what Churchill wrote. And here's a lesson as to the methods that are doomed to fail in dealing with the ruthless. In The Gathering Storm, Churchill wrote this. In due course, on April 15th through 17th, 1935, the Council of the League of Nations examined the alleged breaches of the Treaty of Versailles committed by Germany in decreeing universal compulsory military service. So here's the scene. The Germans had agreed to the Treaty of Versailles after World War I. They had agreed to every point in that treaty that this is the way we're going to live, but now Hitler violated the Treaty of Versailles by demanding compulsory military service for every man in Germany. Everybody in Germany's got to become a soldier. That was against the Treaty of Versailles, so the League of Nations got together to deal with the problem. Now listen. The following powers were represented on the Council: the Argentine Republic, Australia, Great Britain, Chile, Czechoslovakia, Denmark, France, Germany, Italy, Mexico, Poland, Portugal, Spain, Turkey, and the USSR. All these powers voted for the principle that treaties should not be broken by unilateral action and referred the issue to the Plenary Assembly of the League. At the same time, the foreign ministers of the three Scandinavian countries, Sweden, Norway, and Denmark, and of Holland, being deeply concerned about the naval balance in the Baltic, also met together in general support. Now listen to these words. In all 19 countries formally protested. But how vain was all their voting without the readiness of any single power or any group of powers to contemplate the use of force, even in the last resort. That could be like the United Nations today, isn't it? History is repeating itself. History is absolutely repeating itself. It's not just echoing. It's repeating itself. And it's repeating itself because people have not learned the lessons of previous generations, and because they haven't learned the lessons, they're doomed to repeat the failures. And this is what we're witnessing today. God has revealed how to deal with the ruthless and with those who contemplate evil or carry it out. Here's what God says to do. Instill fear in them. The civil authority better be a cause of fear to the one who contemplates evil. And for somebody who actually carries out evil, the civil authority better become an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. That's God's method. That's what God says in His holy word. He calls us to instill fear in them, and if they carry it out, to avenge the innocent and punish them even to death. Yesterday I received somebody forwarded a wonderful email to me that I want to read in total. It's entitled, "Dear Terrorist, I am a Naval Aviator. A letter from the Hornet community." You might wonder, what is that? Well, the Hornet community are those aviators who fly the F-18 Hornet. Here's a wonderful letter from a naval aviator. It's so biblical. It's so right on. And to be quoted in any message on Romans 13 and verse 4, it fits. Listen to this letter. "Dear terrorist, I am a naval aviator. I was born and raised in a small town in New England. I come from a family of five. I was raised in a middle-class home and taught my values by my mother and father. My dad worked a series of jobs in finance, and my mom took care of us kids. We were not an overly religious family, but attended church most Sundays. It was a nice small Episcopal church. I have a brother and a sister, and I'm the youngest in my family. I was the first in many generations to attend college. I've flown naval aircraft for 16 years. For me, the flying was never a lifelong dream or a calling. It just happened. I needed a job, and I liked the challenge. I continue to do it today because I feel it's important to give back to a nation which has given so much to me. I do it because although I will never be rich, my family will be comfortable. My government has spent millions to train me to fly these multi-million dollar aircraft. I make $70,000 a year. and after 20 years will be offered a pension. I like baseball, but think that the players make too much money. I am in awe of firemen and policemen and what they do each day for my community, and I like teachers, they just don't get paid enough. I respect my elders and always use sir or ma'am when addressing a stranger. I'm not sure about kids these days, but I think that's normal for every generation. I voted for George Bush, not for his IQ, but because I like him. I think I made a pretty good choice. I tell you all this because when I come for you, I want you to know me. I won't be hiding behind a woman or a child. I won't be disguised or pretending to be something I am not. I will be in a U.S. issue flight suit. I will be wearing standard U.S. issue flight gear. And I will be flying a Navy aircraft clearly marked as a U.S. warplane. I wish we could meet up close in a small room where I could wrap my hands around your throat and slowly squeeze the life out of you, but unfortunately you're hiding in a hole in the ground, so we will have to do this a different way. I want you also to know that I'm very good at what I do. I can put a 2,000-pound weapon through a window from 10,000 feet up. I generally only fly at night, so you may want to start sleeping during the day. I am not eager to die for my country, but I am willing to sacrifice my life to protect it from animals like you. I will do everything in my power to ensure that no civilians are hurt as I take aim at you. My countrymen are a forgiving bunch. Many are already forgetting what you did on September 11th, but I will not forget, and my president will not forget. I am coming. I hope you know me a little bit better. See you soon. Sleep tight. Signed, U.S. Navy pilot. And I say to myself, how biblical that is. How right that is. If the Scripture says that there's a time for war, then brethren, do you not understand that there's a time for warriors? And that's just the modern warrior. And God in His holy word says that the function of the civil government is to instill fear in the one who would practice evil, and if they carry out the evil, to bring vengeance and bring wrath against them for carrying it out. And I thank God for men like that. I thank God for men like that. In the last place, there's a lesson as to how we view the vocations that are part of this ministry of God. Our confession of faith says the following. I invite you to turn with me. You're being patient, but just be patient. I'm not going to make two messages out of this, and since you're not coming back tonight because of the snowstorm, we're going to do it all this morning. But our confession of faith says this. Page 683. Chapter 24 on the civil magistrate. Notice with me, paragraphs 1 and 2. Page 683 in your hymnals. God, the supreme Lord and King of all the world, has ordained civil magistrates to be under Him over the people for His own glory and the public good, and to this end hath armed them with the power of the sword for defense and encouragement of them that do good and for the punishment of evildoers. It is lawful for Christians to accept and execute the office of a magistrate when called thereunto, in the management whereof, as they ought especially to maintain justice and peace, according to the wholesome laws of each kingdom and commonwealth, so that for that end they may lawfully now under the New Testament wage war upon just and necessary conditions. See, our confession of faith said that if you're going to have the civil magistrate, and if the civil magistrate is to instill fear in the one who would practice evil or avenge wrongs when somebody does practice evil and bring wrath against the one who would practice evil, then Christians can be part of that, can become part of the whole system. And they can wage war upon just and necessary conditions. What that teaches us and what Romans 13 requires us to believe is this. There is a lesson as to how we view the vocations that are a part of this ministry of God. I would ask you this question. How would you view it if your son wanted to become a police officer or a warrior in any of the branches of our armed services? Would you think that that decision was a waste? Would you think that that decision was morally wrong? If you would think that, I am ashamed of you. If your son ever decides he wants to become a fireman or a policeman, or a sailor or a marine, or a soldier or an airman, he is making a decision to go into a calling that is not only legitimate but honorable. I read a very interesting book 2 weeks ago. Believe it or not, I listen to NPR, National Public Radio. I like to listen to what the enemy's doing and thinking. And I heard an excerpt on NPR from this book. And so I went right out to the bookstore and bought it. I was so impressed by the excerpt that I heard read. It's a book by Frank Schaefer and his son John Schaefer entitled Keeping Faith, a father-son story about love in the United States Marine Corps. I didn't know when I bought the book that Frank Schaefer is the son of Francis Anita Schaefer. And John Schaefer is the grandson of Francis Anita Schaefer, the great Christian apologists and missionaries. There's a lot in this book that I don't like and that you won't like if you read it. You will not like Frank Schaefer's ethics as he sneaks his son into movie theaters to watch movies without paying the fare and violates the Eighth Commandment. You will not like his language as he writes. You will not like the way in which he denounces the Reformed heritage of his father and mother, Francis Anita Schaefer. And you will not like reading about how he succumbed to the smells and the bells of Eastern Orthodoxy and became Eastern Orthodox in his religion. Those things you will not like. That is, if you're thinking clearly. But there are many things that you will like about this book. And this is a book that is timely for the United States of America at this present time to teach us that if your son wants to become a U.S. Marine or a sailor or an airman or a soldier or a policeman or a fireman, he's pursuing an honorable vocation and should be commended and praised and not denounced. Listen to this selection from Keeping Faith, the testimony of Frank Schaefer. After John started thinking about the Corps, I got some interesting reactions. "Wow, your son is a heck of an athlete," said the wealthy father of another player as we stood on the sidelines of a wearing soccer match. Here the kid grew up in the Boston area, went to a prestigious prep school, on a track to an Ivy League education. And so the father and son just standing on the sidelines of the soccer game, and the father says, "Wow, your son's a heck of an athlete." And I said, "Thank you. Where's he going to school next year?" He's thinking of going into the Marines. Is money an issue? Because, you know, what with those poems he read at the last school concert and his athletic ability, he could get a scholarship. "No, we can afford school." "Then why?" "He wants to." "But he's so bright and talented and could do anything." "What a waste." The father got very busy with his cell phone and scurried to the sideline. Moments later, he cruised off in his behemoth 1 mile to the gallon SUV, replete with a Stanford decal, front and center on the tinted rear window. And as I paced the sidelines, I was seething. He continues, "Why was I so shocked when my son joined the military? Had we all become pacifists? Did our educated upper class cease to profit from American power? Did we no longer need a military? Was the world a safe place? Did America have no enemies or international responsibilities? Had God ordained that after, say, 1968, only the middle and lower middle classes, and especially the poor, should defend our country? We were no longer in the Vietnam War, but the attitudes of many of my educated peers still seem stuck in the late 60s. One impeccably dressed middle-aged lady in a movie theater on the Upper West Side in Manhattan expressed an attitude that I came to find infuriating. The theater was running pre-feature commercials. One was for the Marine Corps. I heard the woman behind me groan loudly, then say to her companion that she didn't think it should be allowed since it was such a disgusting display of jingoism. She had not complained about the Pepsi commercial moments before. Look at those people trying to trick the poor, uneducated young men into thinking that the military is such a great thing, with all that patriotic, chauvinistic blank, she said. Trick them into what? I wanted to yell. Into living on food stamps while they defend your rich, moldy blank? Later on in the subway, I was still making up speeches of what I would have said, should have said, would say next time. Does the Upper West Side issue its own passports now? Last time I checked, New York was still in the USA, lady. Who the heck do you think is protecting you, the sanitation department? Well, that's great. I'm glad. You know, 1 minute's worth of quoting cost me $25, but you needed to hear that. You needed to hear that. Because if your son decides he wants to be a policeman or a fireman or a marine or a soldier or an airman or a sailor, don't you act the way those people acted. He would be choosing an absolutely honorable profession. William Bennett said the following with regard in his excellent book entitled Why We Fight, Moral Clarity in the War on Terrorism. William Bennett said this, and just listen to what he said. Parents and teachers have been cautioned by psychologists and feminists alike that male aggression is a wild and malignant force that needs to be repressed or medicated lest it burst out, as it is always on the verge of doing, in murderous behavior. The 1999 shooting spree by two teenagers at Columbine High School in Colorado is taken to be all too hardly typical. In the meantime, the Boy Scouts of America, an irreplaceable institution that's always known how to channel the healthy impulses of male aggression and to inspire male idealism, is derided as irrelevant, patriarchal, and bigoted. But teaching children that you should never be violent does an unforgivable injury both to them and to the adult community of which they're about to become a part. It renders them vulnerable to abuse and injury and leaves them without moral or intellectual recourse when abuse and injury are inflicted upon them. If no distinction is made among kinds of peace, children are deprived of the tools they require to distinguish a just from an unjust peace, peace with honor from the peace of the grave. They are robbed of the oldest and most necessary wisdom of the race, which is that some things are worth fighting and dying for. Are we to tell our children that because you should always find a peaceful way to solve your problems, that the brave men who fought in the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, the two World Wars, and every other conflict in our history were acting immorally? That way lies a generation prepared only for accommodation, appeasement, and surrender. War is an ugly thing, but not the ugliest of things. The decayed and degraded state of a moral and patriotic feeling which thinks that nothing is worth war is much worse. And here he's quoting John Stuart Mill. Listen to this. A man who has nothing for which he's willing to fight, nothing he cares about more than his own safety, is a miserable creature who has no chance of being free unless made and kept so by the exertions of better men than himself. And I'm here to tell you that that 21-year-old Marine that is now in Kuwait, sleeping on the ground in a two-man tent, is a better man than the majority of the population in North Boston. He's a better man. Bennett said the following, "Today's pacifists owe their very lives to the America that stopped Hitler non-pacifically." Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones said he never met a pacifist who understood the Christian doctrine of the atonement. Never met one. Well, may God help our leaders to fulfill their God-ordained function. I know that book so moved me in reading it. This one here, I read it in a day with copious notes. It so affected me in reading that book that I said to my wife, "Honey, I want you to know something I'm going to do whenever I'm at any airport in America today. I'm flying here or there. I see some young Marine, some young sailor, sitting there alone with his bag. I'm going to go up to that young guy and I'm going to open my wallet. I'm going to give him $20. And I'm going to say, here, you go have a good lunch on me as an appreciative American. And if you would do anything less, or never even thought about doing anything like that, you don't understand Romans 13 and the vital function of the civil authority to maintain a God-honoring way of life so that you and I can travel in peace and in safety. God-ordained tasks, as revealed here in Romans 13, are what we should pray that our leaders will actually accomplish. May God help our leaders to fulfill their God-ordained task. Weak leaders like Neville Chamberlain make huge blunders and allow the wicked to go on and prosper. And weak leaders always get more people killed than strong leaders do any day in the week. The theme of Winston Churchill's multi-volume history of World War II was this: how the English-speaking peoples, through their unwisdom, carelessness, and good nature, allowed the wicked to rearm. And because the English-speaking peoples, through their unwisdom, through their carelessness, and through their good nature, allowed the wicked to rearm, we had World War II. A war that could have easily been prevented had the English-speaking peoples not been careless, had they been wise, had they been resolute, had they been determined to say a violation of what you agreed to is serious and we're going to deal with it. We're seeing played out before our very eyes the Chamberlainization of the West. Gerhard Schroeder, Jacques Chirac, they're just modern Neville Chamberlains. Thank God that Tony Blair and George Bush are modern Churchills. This is what we need for this hour. May God bless our understanding of His holy word and what it teaches about the civil magistrate.